For nearly two centuries, societies have weighed the merits of free market capitalism and socialism. Debates continue over which system maximizes prosperity and better promotes human flourishing. Free market capitalism decentralizes economic decisions, giving individuals control over what to produce, how much to charge, and what to buy. Their decisions are informed by market prices, which convey important information about scarcity and consumer value. Proponents contend that capitalism delivers the best economic outcomes by giving individuals incentives to create and produce. Critics, on the other hand, point to the persistence of poverty in market economies and rising inequality as proof that capitalism fails to deliver broad-based prosperity. They maintain that this inequality ultimately gives the rich disproportionate economic and political power. In contrast, socialism grants the government the authority to make most economic decisions. The government chooses how to allocate scarce resources based upon what it determines to be most useful to society as a whole. Proponents argue that socialism ensures society's resources are fairly distributed. Critics claim that socialism fails to give people proper economic incentives to innovate and produce, which ultimately reduces economic opportunities for all. Opponents further argue that socialism's powerful central governments become autocratic and threaten political freedom. So which system is better for humanity? For as long as this question has been asked, the debate all too often devolves into name-calling and emotional arguments that fail to advance the discussion. And yet, it is imperative that we keep asking. The Human Prosperity Project at the Hoover Institution seeks to overcome these preconceptions. It employs analysis of free market capitalism and socialism and its many variants to assess how each system affects human flourishing.
Good morning and welcome to a new speaker series of the Hoover Institution called The Human Prosperity Project. I'm Tom Gilligan, director of the Hoover Institution. The speaker series is based on the scholarly research and commentary written by Hoover Fellows participating in the Human Prosperity Project on Socialism and Free Market Capitalism. The overreaching goal of this project is to objectively investigate the historical record to assess the consequences for human welfare, individual liberty, and interactions between nations of various economic systems. This project is research-based with educational and policy-oriented outputs that include long-form essays, short videos, commentary, and this speaker series. This speaker series is just one of the many ways we are able to reach out and share some of the important work coming out of the institution. As a reminder, we will be taking audience questions and encourage you to submit yours using the Q&A button located at the bottom of your screen. I'm joined today by two esteemed Hoover colleagues, Ed Lazier and Lee Ohanian, to discuss income inequality, opportunity, and economic growth. Both have written papers on this topic for this project, and they are available online at our website, hoover.org. Ed is the Morris, Arnold, and Nona Jean Cox Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Davies Family Professor of Economics at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. He is a labor economist and served at the White House from 2006 to 2009, where he was chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Before coming to Stanford, he taught at the University of Chicago. Lee is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and a professor of economics and director of the Edinger Family Program in Macroeconomic Research at the University of California at Los Angeles. He is an associate director of the Center for Advanced Study in Economic Efficiency at Arizona State University. And he's a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, where he co-directs the research initiative entitled Macroeconomics Across Time and Space. Lee and Ed, welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
I
want to ask an opening question to both of you to kind of set the stage, and Ed, you might as well start with you. Many people think that we shouldn't even be having a conversation about socialism and free market capitalism. Socialism, as a practical matter, has vanished or diminished from the world over the past 100 years. Isn't the best evidence of the decline of socialism, isn't that the best evidence of the decline of its shortcomings?
Well, it's certainly true that if we look at the recent history of the world, the last few decades, it's very rare for countries to make radical moves from capitalism to socialism. The reverse is true. Obviously, there are exceptions, cases like Venezuela, but they are the rare exception. But it's clear that in the developed countries, the richer countries, this debate is still going on. And in fact, I would argue that it's current even this week. We saw it become a lively component of the conversation. President Trump started out a couple of days ago by charging that former Vice President Biden was a Trojan horse for socialism. I don't know if you recall that statement that he made, but then, of course, Mr. Biden decided to help make that credible by issuing statements that sort of back that up. So if you go back to July, Biden said, it's way past time to put an end to the era of shareholder capitalism. He chose Kamala Harris as his running mate. Senator Harris has the most liberal voting record in Congress, in the Senate, which includes Bernie Sanders. And she's still rated as the most liberal. And speaking of Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders just said in his remarks at the Democratic National Convention that if the proposals that they have in the Unity Task Force, so Vice President Biden and Bernie Sanders got together, issued some proposals, and Sanders said, well, if those proposals are implemented, Biden will be the most progressive president since FDR. So while we might think that socialism is dead, these are certainly indications that many people in our country are thinking that a strong move in that direction might be warranted.
Yeah, Lee, do you agree? Is socialism still a lively topic for debate?
Well, Tom, it's interesting. In the last 30 or 40 years, the world's become much freer, much more democratic, much more oriented towards market economies. We've seen the benefits of that in terms of world economic growth. About half of the world's population in the 1980s lived in extreme poverty, which is what the World Bank, a nonpartisan international development organization, calls living on $1.75 or less a day. So let's just think about that. Half of the world was living on $1.75 or less a day as recently as the 1980s. And now that's very thankfully down to 5%. So we've seen a coincidence of a move away from socialist type governments in economic systems to more market-oriented systems. And that's coincided with enormous increase in human well-being. But as Eddie noted, even though socialism purely is an economic idea, I think the empirical records are very clear on what it does. It doesn't deliver prosperity. But now socialism is being cocooned not just as an economic idea, but also with cultural significance and social significance, and it's becoming very attractive to a number of groups, particularly young people. In the Democratic primary, those in here in California, 40 million people, 60% of those voting in the Democratic primary in the 18 to 44 age range voted for Bernie Sanders. And his economic ideas are remarkably different than what we have in place right now.
Yeah, interesting. Let's turn and focus on capitalism for a second. And Eddie, let me ask you this question first. Inequality has risen in most countries over recent decades under capitalism. Is that problematic for those who are pro-capitalism?
Well, let me answer it in a couple of ways. First, the first question I think we want to ask is whether inequality is the right measure of a system's benevolence. So I think what you're getting at, Tom, is the point that was actually made in the video, that many people think that capitalism may be better in terms of creating growth, but it's somewhat harsh and unkind, unforgiving, doesn't look after the poor well enough. So the way I would think about this is what we care about is not so much the difference between the rich and the poor, but how well do the poor fare? Yeah. That's an important point because we can certainly look at countries where inequality has grown and grown significantly, but the welfare of the poor has gone up tremendously. The most obvious case is China. I mean, China, if you look at China over the past three decades or so, current period notwithstanding, what you'll see is after Deng Xiaoping liberalized the market and moved to the market economy, inequality skyrocketed. It went from having the rich defined as the top 10% to the poor defined as the bottom 10%, going from 8 times to 40 times. You look at that, you say, gosh, that's staggering. But at the same time, the income of the bottom 5% went up fivefold. So if you ask that group, you know, would you rather be living back in the 80s when everybody was the same, but we're all in poverty, or would you rather be living now? Chances are you'd rather be in the current economy. The second point I would make, and Lee actually discussed this as well, but it's a really important point. So I want to just echo it. What we care about is world inequality, not so much within country inequality. That within country may be important, but world inequality has actually gone down. It has not gone up. And the reason for that is that the poorest countries in the world, that were also the largest countries in the world, China and India, among the poorest countries in the world, have seen tremendous growth, China the most, of course, but India too. And so you've had a much larger group of people who were in poverty moving into the middle class. And so if you take the world as the unit of analysis rather than the individual countries, what you see is that the bottom has come up, actually reducing inequality.
Yeah, Eddie, let me push on that a little bit. Kent, you know, your example of China where it went from 10 to 10 to 4 to 40, something, the difference like that. Can't the poor get richer by making the system work more in their favor and less in favor of the rich? Do we need those levels of inequality in order to help pull up the poor?
Well, that's the key issue. And I think the critics of capitalism would actually make that point and argue that the problem with capitalism is it works for the rich and it doesn't work for the poor. Mm-hmm. Most of the paper that I wrote as background for this particular session actually suggests that's not the case. Now, if you go back, half a century to President Kennedy's statement that a rising tide lifts all boats. Question is that right? Does a rising tide lift all boats? That's really the issue here, because the argument was if we have positive growth, if we have good growth, everybody is better off. And the answer is, as an empirical matter, President Kennedy was actually right. Now, it doesn't mean that all groups grow at exactly the same time and at exactly the same rate. But if we look at this historically and we look at what's actually happened, what you tend to see is that the lowest income groups do not see income grow in periods when the highest income groups do not see income grow. So, for example, in my data, I have data on 161 countries over a few decades, so it's a very large data set, comprehensive data set. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that, what you'll see is that in 82% of the decades where the top 10%'s income grew, it was also the case that the bottom 10%'s income grew. Mm-hmm. And the converse was also true. It was rarely the case that the bottom grew when the top didn't grow. So again, the sort of beggar thy neighbor view of the world where, you know, the bottom gets better when the top gets worse just doesn't seem to be true as an empirical statement.
Practical matter. Got it. Lee, let me ask you a question about the following. A growing number of people view inequality and economic opportunity as fundamentally a left-right political issue. Do you agree with that characterization? And if not, how should we think about these important policy issues?
Inequality and growth and opportunities across different demographic groups are first and foremost an economic issue. And I think our society is suffering because many do tie inequality. It's wrapped up as a very politicized issue, is very much a left-right issue. As Eddie noted, a beggar thy neighbor type issue. There are the haves and have-nots, a zero-sum game. And I think that really takes us away from sober discussions about solutions and how we can develop policies that enhance opportunities, particularly for those young people, those at the lower income scale. There are many people in this country who struggle daily, and we want to develop policies that help them. And politicizing inequality does not help them whatsoever. If I could just go back and touch on a point Eddie made when he talked about how Vice President Biden and Senator Elizabeth Warren have called out for corporate charters in which it's explicitly stated that a corporate goal should be the broader social good. And I think by making inequality political, we have very misinformed suggestions for policies. And and just take a look at one corporation, Apple Corporation, that developed the smartphone, which has more computing power than a supercomputer from 20 years ago. So we walk around with this remarkable computer in our pocket. And they did that for the benefit of their shareholders. And if we look at what's going on in Africa today, Africa is growing at remarkably fast rates. They're still poor, but they're moving in the right direction. And why is that? Well, the World Bank has issued a study in which they call the cell phone as the most revolutionary impact hitting Africa, and how it is unilaterally raising people in Africa out of poverty. So we want the Jeff Bezoses of the world. We want the Bill Gates of the world. We want those people to be creative and come up with ideas that transform our world, because what they gain from that is just is one grain of sand on the beach of the world. And they've done enormous good by making our world a much more prosperous place.
Yeah, got it. If you're just joining us, I'm Tom Gilligan, and this is the Hoover Institution's Human Prosperity Project speaker series with Ed Lazier and Lee Ohanian. Lee, let me stick with you for a second. I want to ask you a little bit about government policy. What are governments not doing but they should be doing to increase opportunities and address inequality?
So I think we can do a lot better at the state, local government level, at the national government level. We live here in California. Just give you a quick example. California recently passed a law that took effect this year that outlaws the ability of people to work as independent contractors, unless you're in a profession such as a physician or attorney or dentist. But what this law did was essentially tell many people who work, say, in landscape architects, or those who drive for Uber or Lyft or DoorDash, that you no longer can work as an independent contractor. And that's a regulation that just, for no better reason, just gets in the way of a voluntary exchange between somebody who wants to work and earn an income and somebody who needs that service. In terms of capitalism, it's the only economic system that we have in which people voluntarily do things for each other. It's the only one we have. And that's why I think is that it's the only one that's ever going to work. It's the only one that's consistent with our DNA. If there's one aspect of government policy that I think we should be changing, is policy towards education. We force many poor families to have one choice for a school. Oftentimes in poor neighborhoods, schools aren't performing very well. Introducing very modest reforms, sensible reforms in terms of school choice, in terms of enhancing competition, making modest changes to teacher union contracts, has been shown to make a world of difference in terms of educational outcomes. And if we want young people to be able to pursue their dreams and succeed, they have to have the education to succeed in a world that's becoming just more global every day.
Yeah, Lee. Eddie, so Lee thinks that the government should stop getting in the way of voluntary exchange, and they should provide more educational opportunities for people. What else do you think the government should stop doing and should do to address inequality and economic opportunity?
Well, I think Lee has probably nailed the most important issue, but let me take a step back on that and ask, why is it that inequality has been growing over time? Because I think everybody agrees this is not a good thing. We don't like the fact that the wealthiest people in the United States, and it's actually not even the wealthiest, it's the top half is moving away from the bottom half. And that's not a good development. So the question is, why is that? What's causing that to occur? Is that some conspiracy? Is it because of monopoly? Is it because capitalists are greedy? Capitalists may very well be greedy, but that doesn't necessarily explain the phenomenon that we're seeing. So let me give you a little bit of data on that, because I've looked at that, not so much in the paper that is the basis for today's talk, but in some other work I did. And I looked at that, and essentially what's going on is this can be explained by differences in productivity and productivity growth over time. So what's been happening is technology has changed in a way that has caused the productivity of people who are college educated and better to rise, and to rise pretty rapidly, while those of people who don't make it to college are basically flat. They're lagging behind. Mm-hmm. So while that's the reason for it, that doesn't mean it's an excuse. The fact that we know what's causing the problem doesn't mean that we can ignore the problem. And I think then we get back to what Lee was talking about. And the question is, well, how do you remedy that? If it's the case that the bottom 50% is just lagging behind the top 50%, what do you do about it? Lee mentioned education. I would also mention education, but I have a slightly different point that I might emphasize. One of the problems, and it's kind of ironic, it's a result of our optimism. One of the problems in education in the United States is that we believe everybody can succeed, and we want everybody to succeed. So everybody should go to college. Everybody should become an electrical engineer. We have aspirations, high aspirations for everyone in society, and we don't want to write people off. That's great. One of the negative aspects of that, though, is that for those people who end up not going to college, and not everybody does go to college, they are trained in a curriculum that doesn't give them the skills to make them productive when they are then out in the labor force. So they basically have a watered down pre-college curriculum, which has very little value in the kinds of jobs that they're actually doing. Yeah. So the contrast would be countries like the German-speaking countries in Europe, which are the best, Germany, Austria, Switzerland. They have excellent vocational training, and their people who go through that training do much better. Now, I want to just make clear that vocational training, when we think about vocational training, we're thinking about plumbers and electricians, and that's fine. Those people earn pretty good salaries, as we know. But that's not what their vocational training is about. Vocational training means providing skills that help them when they get to the labor market. Most of those jobs are service jobs. They could be something like a hotel manager. They could be a lab technician. But the difference is what those individuals are getting when they are in our equivalent of high school are skills that make them productive in the labor market, and it shows up in the data. So if you look at Germany, the average voc-ed graduate is earning 90% of what the average would be in the United States. It's 70% for high school graduates. So I would argue that's a reflection of the fact that their educational system actually trains people to do things that they need to be doing.
Interesting. So there's a bit of a mismatch in our educational system right now for what we need in the labor markets.
That's what I would argue. And obviously, we don't necessarily have to go all the way in the direction of what Germany has done. In fact, they are moving a bit back in our direction because they track people very early. There are some problems with their system as well. Right. But at least some focus on providing our high school kids who end up not going to college, or even if they go to community colleges, with the kinds of skills that they actually would be using in the labor force, would make them more productive and would be reflected in higher earnings. So that would be the most obvious thing that I would emphasize in terms of changing the educational curriculum.
Yeah, got it. Lee, we have a question from the audience I want to read. John Power asked, is there a fair way to distinguish the difference between true socialism and a social welfare state? And I want to enrich that question by asking, you know, many people will point to Nordic or Scandinavian countries as examples of successful socialism. How do you address John's question and answer the claim that Scandinavia offers the best example of successful socialism?
Sure. John, that's a really good question. There's a lot of misinformation about what Scandinavia does and what people think they do. Senator Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, point to Sweden in particular saying, hey, that's the country I think we should emulate. Well, if you look at the economic policies in those countries, they are remarkably different than what Sanders and AOC believe some of them to be. Next year, Sweden will have a lower corporate tax rate than the United States. That's very different than what Sanders advocates for, and that's something very different what he thinks goes on there. Sweden has for-profit K-12 education and a well-established school voucher system. That, again, is very, very different than what Sanders and AOC believe. Sweden and Denmark do have larger public sectors, partially because they provide more public goods, particularly in the area of healthcare. We don't have time to go into the pluses, the minuses of European healthcare, but the facts are that Sweden in particular, and most of Europe, is moving towards privatizing their healthcare because all of those countries' healthcare systems are running into budget, very difficult budget circumstances, and the health outcomes are not nearly as good as what people think they should be. So there are varying shades of gray in issues such as peer socialism, which we really have never seen other than USSR, Yugoslavia, Russia, places like that, and then how big a society wants their government sector to be. Sweden and Denmark have chosen to have somewhat bigger social sectors or government sectors. And what's interesting is that they fund those public sectors with a much more regressive tax system than what we have here, a tax system that is far, far from what Sanders and AOC are recommending.
Mm-hmm. Eddie, do you have any comments on that?
Well, I would just follow up again with Lee's point. First of all, I think the way the left would argue this is, in fact, they accept the notion that Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Norway are inherently capitalist. They have mostly private ownership. They have mostly market-determined prices. They have limited regulations. If you look at the labor market, for example, in Denmark, it's as mobile as the one in the United States. So they would point to that and say, yeah, that's exactly the point. They have that. And yet they have these large redistributive transfers and they take care of their poor much better than we do. So I think that's a legitimate concern. It's a legitimate criticism, something that we really do need to address. Now, if you look at the data, and again, using the 161 countries that I looked at over the past few decades, it is in fact true that countries with large government sectors, as Lee pointed out, do engage in more redistribution, and the poor are relatively better off in those countries. I say relatively better off because the country itself may be poorer, but in terms of the inequality, they are relatively better off. No denying that. So that's true. But there are two points that go along with that. The first one is that redistribution is a luxury. So if you divide the sample of countries into the countries that redistribute the most and the countries that redistribute the least, just divide them in half, okay, and say, are you in the, above the median or below the median? Right. What you find is that the income of the countries that are above the median are more than twice as high as the incomes of the countries that are below the median. So basically, the ability to redistribute is a luxury good. It is something that only wealthy countries can afford. Now, of course, we're a wealthy country. Yeah. And so critics would say, well, we're in that group. Why don't we do more of this stuff? Fair enough. But that has to be taken into account with the fact that longer term growth depends on the government sector. So Lee alluded to this earlier, but if you look at the relationship between the size of the government, you look at the relationship between government spending and economic growth, that relationship is negative. The bigger the government, the lower the growth rate. So let's go back to Scandinavia. Denmark, Finland, great countries, very high standards of living, nice places to live, spent a lot of time in both places. But the reality is those countries also have low growth rates. So what that tells us is that if you move in that direction, the cost is going to be reduced growth for the future, which will then affect everybody's income in the future, including the poor. So that's, I think that's the trade-off that we have to bear in mind.
Yeah, got it.
You know, Tom, could I just add one item to Eddie's comment, which was terrific. In the U.S., we redistribute quite a bit, enough such that consumption per capita, not income, but consumption per capita in the lowest 20% is about the same as the 60th percentile in France. Mm-hmm. We redistribute a little bit less than France redistributes, but we're a much richer country than France. So from a consumption perspective, we are consuming across the board more than ever. And the consumption per capita of those in the bottom quintile is about half per capita of those in the top 20%. And from a consumption perspective, there's much less inequality than in income because we do engage in quite a bit of redistribution in this country.
Yeah, got it. I want to ask you, this question may sound a little bit technical, but I want to see if I can elicit some interesting comments. Transitions from socialism to capitalism and vice versa taking place in countries, and they take different forms and have different consequences. Could you talk a little bit about some of the examples of this?
To me?
Yeah, please.
Okay, sure. That's a really great point, Tom. If you look at the differences across countries, the patterns can be quite different. We've already talked about China. So remember what happened in China, they obviously are not a democracy with free market capitalism at this point, but they've certainly moved in that direction since the early 80s. And what you saw there was big increases in inequality at the same time that you saw increases in the level of income among the poor. So two things happened. The rich got rich, and the rich got rich a lot faster than the poor got rich, but both got rich at the same time. That's one pattern. If you look at the former Soviet economies, the pattern there is quite different. What happened in the former Soviet economies, you know, remember the transition there took place in the early to mid 90s. And if you look at the data from those countries, everybody got killed. I mean, that transition was extremely painful in terms of the fall in income, but the poor really got killed. So if you look at the poor in the Soviet Union and some of the satellite countries, the rich got hurt, but the lowest 10% just got devastated. And that was that was the nature of their particular transition. There are other examples that go the other way. Chile, which unfortunately right now for the past year or so has had protests over the way income has gone for the poor. Ironically, Chile is one of the best examples of the poor moving parallel to the rich. So what happened in Chile, when they moved from the socialism under Allende to the more free market kinds of things that they saw under his successor, obviously controversial successor, Pinochet. What happened was the income of the rich rose and the income of the poor rose, and they rose in parallel. So we do see differences. You could look at Hong Kong, which is not, we saw terrific development in Hong Kong. Look at Vietnam in the past two decades. They're moving in the direction of the market. Again, a little bit of an increase in inequality. The rich have gotten richer relative to the poor. But the bigger story there is that the poor have seen their income grow 2.5 times in a couple of decades. So again, there are differences. What that tells us is that we have to be careful about the way this is done. And we have to make sure that the very poor don't fall through the cracks as they did in the Soviet Union. And that was actually devastating. I mean, there are horror tales that we can tell about Russia in the 1990s.
Yeah, got it. Lee, I have a question from the audience I want to put to you since you brought this up earlier, and it's from Christian Millard. He says, socialism has never delivered on its mantra of equality of outcomes. So why do so many young people embrace socialism as an economic/political and social model of liberty and prosperity?
Great point, Christian. I think I'm going to be preaching to the choir here, and it leads me to remember. A lot of times, people will say things like, "Socialism is great in theory, but it doesn't work in practice." And my response to that is that it's a lousy theory because it never works in practice. We've experimented with it many times, and it has never worked. So I think young people are led to it really for two reasons. One is that there's social aspects and cultural aspects of socialism that are being connected with the economic ideas. Some people who espouse socialism are very young, and I think are very media savvy. They connect well with young people, such as AOC. And I think there's another, more troubling aspect to why people are being drawn to these ideas is that there's a lot of misinformation out there about what economic outcomes are under socialism, what they are under capitalism. For example, a great example is during Bernie Sanders' campaign, both in 2016 and this last campaign, he would make statements such as, the American worker has not gotten a raise since 1970. Mm-hmm. And that's simply just not true. What is true is that if looking at compensation, which includes non-wage compensation, rather than just narrowly wages, shows a much different picture, and that's the picture we should be looking at. Sanders was just looking at wages and getting technical, deflating by the price index that wasn't the right price index. But to get to the point, non-wage benefits in the 1970s were about 6% of a person's overall compensation. Today, they're about 35%. Wow. When we look at compensation since 1970, it's up about 100%, taking into account non-wage benefits and deflating by the appropriate price index. So there's a lot of misinformation out there as well that I think is driving some young people towards socialism.
Interesting. How about another question from Amy Duncan, and I want to get you both to comment on it. I want to start with Ed. Amy says, both speakers touched on education. Would you comment on raising teacher salaries / incentives such as loan forgiveness in order to attract and retrain staff, provide educational opportunities, etc.? And could you talk a little bit about examples of other countries that do better at this than the U.S. And Eddie, if you could start. And Lee, I know that you study the impacts of teacher unions on policy change and reform in the U.S. And if you could say some things on that after Eddie, I'd appreciate it.
Sure.
Well, in full disclosure, I'm a bit conflicted on this one because I'm actually one of those people who received loan money when I was an undergraduate in college that was actually forgiven because I became a teacher. Obviously I have personal interest in those kinds of programs, but if I think about that more objectively and in terms of the specific issue, there are very strong indications that the countries that do best in education are the ones that pay their teachers more. Now, we think, gosh, we have such strong teachers' unions. Why is it that if we have these strong teachers' unions, teachers are so badly paid? I think part of that is a result of the political structure. The way that teachers are able to exert their power is most easily done if they do it in the form of benefits that seem to be for the children rather than for themselves. For example, reduced class size. Oh, that's for the kids. Well, reduced class size is also a way to reduce the workload. So what's actually happened with very strong teachers unions is they have not been able to raise their salaries particularly, but they have changed the working conditions tremendously in the schools. And I think that's what we're seeing. Now, what's also true, one of our colleagues, Caroline Hoxby, who's a very distinguished education economist, Rick Hanishek, another one of our very distinguished education economists, have looked at this. And what we know is that the people who become teachers in the United States tend to be in the lower part of the college distribution. That is, if you look at their SAT scores when they're entering college, they're not the best. They're not the highest. Maybe they shouldn't be the highest. But the point is, when you have low pay, you're not going to attract the best people into those professions. So I think what we should be examining is the level of pay, but also pay based on performance, to make sure that we're not paying people simply to enter to become teachers and to stay there. That's a very compressed salary structure, which probably under rewards the top teachers and over rewards the bottom teachers. That's something I think that we need to be looking at more carefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with Eddie's point, just to follow up a bit. Teacher unions do seem to be an impediment to many reforms that we would like to see based on just standard marketplace logic, such as the introduction of merit-based pay and pay that depends upon specialty. It's difficult to hire teachers that really know a lot about math and science at the current salary structure, because the current salary structure is one that's really based on seniority. We might see a 25-year-old teacher who's a specialist in math enter at a salary that's far less than, say, a homeroom teacher who's been in place for 40 years. So that's reform, I think, that just makes a lot of sense, and I think one that we should see, because our kids now, in terms of math proficiency, I mean, I know in California, only about 40% of kids are judged to be proficient in math at grade standard. So as we think about an increasingly complex world, one in which we're competing with every potential worker, we're just sending our kids up to the plate with two strikes on them. And, you know, Eddie mentioned a lot of good points about unions and what they do and maybe potentially what they shouldn't be doing. You know, a few years ago in California, there was a lawsuit that was brought by nine junior high school students, eight of whom were kids of color. And they filed an equal protection lawsuit against the state, a constitutional equal protection lawsuit, because they felt they were getting a lousy education. And the trial judge and some of our Hoover colleagues were plaintiff experts on that case. The trial judge ruled in favor of these kids, these nine junior high school kids, and he struck down teacher tenure, he struck down seniority-based layoffs, and he remarked that the facts provided by the plaintiff's experts were not only compelling about the quality of education these children were receiving, he said they were chilling. So I think there's an awful lot of common sense market-based reforms we can introduce in the teaching profession. And we should pay the best teachers more, because they're, from a cost-benefit perspective, and we're economists, we're all about costs and benefits, they're worth it. They're worth it. Rick's research and Caroline's research shows that you put a good teacher in a classroom and their lifetime income goes up by $250,000. So let's get the right teachers in place and pay them what they're worth.
Yeah, outstanding. Well, we reached the end of our time, guys. Let me ask you one final question. This Human Prosperity Project is about identifying policies that will enhance human welfare. If you could pick one policy to change, what would it be and why? And let's start with you, Lee, and we'll finish with Ed.
I'm gonna cheat a little bit and put two together. I'd love to see a flat tax, and a flat tax that goes along with eliminating a lot of tax credits and tax breaks. And the reason I say that is because I think we all feel that unequal access to the political process is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. In this campaign, the 2016 campaign, I mean, just go back to 2016. President Trump talked about elitism and unequal access, and Bernie Sanders talked about elitism and unequal. They talked about it in very different ways, but I think broadly speaking, we don't want to have that continue. It's hard to eliminate, but one way to eliminate that is by having a flat tax and eliminating a lot of the tax breaks and deductions and tax credits that really are politically motivated and don't really have an economic an economic benefit that's broad-based.
Got it. Eddie?
I'd actually go to the other side of that, not the tax side, but actually the spending side. I think the biggest threat that this country faces right now is low growth. What causes low growth? The thing that causes low growth the most, again, if you look at the developed countries, the rich countries in the world, big governments, high government spending is not good for growth. If you have low growth, you have low income growth, not only among the rich, but also among the poor. So if I'm thinking about how do we help the poor, the way we help the poor is to make sure income grows. The way we make sure income grows is to not overwhelm the economy with an enormous government sector. Now, that's easier said than done.
Sure.
If we look at the numbers going forward and we say, you know, what's the Congressional Budget Office tell us is going to happen a couple decades from now? You know, we're going to be in a situation where we have a deficit of 10% per year. That is not sustainable over the long run. Why is that? What's causing that? Again, let me refer to the work of another Hoover colleague, John Cogan's talked a lot about entitlements, what's gone on with entitlements. How do we get control of entitlement spending? Part of that is that what we do is we focus too much of our entitlement spending toward the middle class. Yeah. Rather than taking care of the poor, who actually should be taken care of, what we do is we have these general programs that just balloon the size of the government, and it's focused on people who don't necessarily need it. So the irony here is it's actually, and I say it's irony, but it's actually the Republicans who are the ones who are most in favor of means testing. The Democrats actually seem to be on the other side of that, particularly with respect to things like Social Security. And the argument is a political one, primarily. FDR said a program for the poor is a poor program. But I think what we need to do is focus our attention, target our expenditures, our redistribution, and our government spending more on those people who need it, and make sure that we put caps on the rate of growth in spending.
Wow, thank you. Ed and Lee, thanks so much for your time this morning and for sharing your thoughts on such an important and timely topic. The next sessions in the Human Prosperity Project speaker series are as follows. On September 3rd, we will discuss the case for economic freedom with George Shultz and John Taylor. On September 17th, Hoover Fellows Terry Anderson and Steve Haber will discuss property rights, innovation, and prosperity. And on October 1st, we will talk to Neil Ferguson and Victor Davis Hanson about the historical perspective of socialism and capitalism. You can find the Hoover Institution and more information on the Human Prosperity Project online at our website, hoover.org. Again, thank you for joining us today, and have a nice weekend.